This is The Illusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, enter language in a seaside knobbly knees competition as a joke, but only went and won. Very proud, very proud. Today's episode is about the shifting meaning of the word queerbaiting. It's a bit related to the last episode that was about rainbow washing, but this time in entertainment. Illusionist News Bulletin, The Illusionist is going on tour with the new live show Your Name Here, which is all about eponyms, those linguistic menaces. The show is a lot of fun, and you get a special Illusionist pencil with your ticket, not available in the shops, not even the pencil boutiques. We'll be performing in Australia in July and Aotearoa New Zealand in August. Gosh, that's soon, so motor over to theillusionist.org/events for tickets to the dates that have already been announced: Canberra, Melbourne, Adelaide, Sydney and Auckland, and there will be more added soon. There are a couple of swears in this episode. On with the show.
I really wanted to talk about these things because I'm a queer historian, but I'm also a big media nerd, and I feel really strongly about queer representation and the way that LGBTQ characters and themes have been portrayed on television and on film and in different forms of media. And we have these tropes and this language of representation and stereotypes that shows up in media right now that has a long, long history. I'm Lee Pfeffer, and I use they, them pronouns, and I am the host and producer of History is Gay podcast. History is Gay is, we like to say that it explores the underappreciated and overlooked queer ladies, gents, and gentle NBs of the unexplored corners of the past, because history has never been as straight as you think. Bits of queerness have existed in all of humanity since humanity existed.
And Lee has been tracking the development of the term queerbaiting, which has been used a few different ways.
I see the term queerbaiting evolving in some circles as like a catch-all term for different disagreements about queer representation. And I think it's important for people to know the history of the term and the ways that it's been used in the past that we can accurately use it to describe what's going on right now. To understand queer baiting, you need to know the history and evolution of what's called queer coding. And they're really mixy-uppy together.
Frolicking around like a basket of puppies.
Right. Yeah. Queer coding, it just means that you're not showing something explicitly. It's not inherently negative or positive. It just depends on how it's used.
For a long time, queer coding was the only option for showing queerness on screen, what with the likes of the Hays Code compelling makers of screen entertainment to self-censor.
Characters couldn't be shown explicitly on screen as gay or as queer, and so you had to hide it in stereotypes and subtext based on this censorship code that banned like immoral behavior on screen, which meant that, you know, anything involving homosexuality, among many other kind of lewd sexual behavior, needed to be done subtextually or in a way that depicted it like negatively and had consequences and punishments. And so you had these stock characters of pansies and sissies. You had terms like confirmed bachelor was a euphemism that people would use, or maiden aunt, or calling an unmarried woman a spinster. So you had these gay stock characters based in these stereotypes, and they had these traditionally cross-gender traits. But what you kind of see that evolve into in some ways is most people nowadays, when they think of like queer coding, a lot of times people can see things like the history of Disney villains. You see these characters, these evil characters that are male, but they're coded with like feminine characteristics or, you know, makeup on male characters, like Jafar in Aladdin or Ursula in Little Mermaid is based off of the drag queen Divine. So it can be used negatively in creating these associations of queerness as a shorthand for villainy or evil. But, you know, some queer-coded characters are written for queer audiences as hints when it's not possible to present an explicit narrative. It's like a subtextual language, and it's a way to say, hey, we see you, even though we can't do this. The big kind of shift is that we don't really hear a lot of queer coding nowadays. The language that gets used a lot is this term queer baiting. It's kind of modeled on the phrase race baiting, which is incitement of racial hatred for a political advantage.
The terms race baiting and race baiter have been in use since at least the 1920s, but became a lot more common in the late 20th and early 21st centuries during the presidential campaigns of the George Bushes. Then in the 2010s, Republican politicians appropriated the word race baiting and flipped the meaning to imply that anti-racism activists were inciting racism against white people. So race baiting gets to be yet another term used to discredit the calling out of racism. The meaning of queer baiting has moved around a bit too over the past few decades. It was quite literal in the 1950s, during the Lavender Scare.
Folks may be familiar with the Red Scare, which was McCarthyism and trying to root out communists from society and from the government. And there was similarly a moral panic in the 1950s where gays and lesbians were fired en masse from government positions and military positions, basically thinking that they like posed a threat to national security, that they were communist sympathizers, that people were really weak-willed and that they were a big security risk. And so law enforcement would engage in entrapment practices and would round up queer people and use queer baiting, is what they had called it at that time, as like information gathering tactics, trying to draw out suspected LGBTQ people, suspected gay people through entrapment by offering what they were pretending as safe spaces, or specifically baiting them into sexual situations, classic entrapment, then suddenly you're arrested for lewd and lascivious behavior and turning them in.
So that was really bait, like you would put a worm on a fish hook.
Exactly, yeah. It really was used as that literal version of the term. The same tactics happened with communists in the Red Scare. There's red baiting, there's race baiting. And so, you know, the evolution of that in the LGBTQ community became queer baiting. And then how it like how it got to what it's used for today is it's started in fandom spaces in the late like 2000s, early 2010s, like blogging sites like LiveJournal and Tumblr. There were multiple different like posts on LiveJournal in different places where people kind of explained the concept, but maybe didn't necessarily call it queer baiting specifically. Different definitions on, you know, places like Urban Dictionary or different websites put an emphasis on the idea of queer baiting as a goal of drawing in LGBTQ audiences and making money from them and earning recognition and kind of brownie points for being progressive in showing potentially queer content without alienating homophobic or conservative viewers by putting in actual, legitimate, sincere, and multifaceted representation. And that's what it evolved into from this 1950s very literal like baiting of people into legally tricky situations to the idea of we're going to apply this as a term to a marketing ploy that we as an oppressed minority are starting to see.
Do you know if there were other terms that had been used to mean that in similar like online spaces?
Well, there's a couple of other, I mean, there were in certain queer spaces online, like slash spaces, which is relationships between characters of the same gender, usually male. And that actually comes from a character name and then a slash and then the character name representing that pairing, that relationship that goes back to Kirk and Spock from Star Trek.
Kirk slash Spock. The earliest known fan fiction that pairs up these two for more than friendship is from 1974, but the internet really allowed slash fiction to take off.
You would see phrases like slash wink bandied around. And I think people kind of look on that a little bit more fondly than the concept of queer baiting. I've seen that used in the same kind of context of like queer coding, where it's, hey, you know, we're going to give you a little wink. We're going to throw these little bits in here as a little nod to you. But where things kind of shifted was once money became involved and once it was like, oh, we can gain this audience that will give us clout, being able to market to queer people, much in the same way that we have, you know, things like pinkwashing and rainbow washing, and suddenly queer people are a marketable audience. But do you want to give up that good middle conservative America money by actually putting in an actual kiss or a long relationship between these characters?
Just a loving wink.
Just a loving wink, yeah. It's like marketing a series or a storyline in a way that suggests like a potential queer romance, and then no homoing it, essentially. Delivering jokes and tension, but not actually progressing towards the romance, and specifically laughing it off and denying it as a possibility.
What to you are the problems with the term queerbaiting being used in the sense of like TV shows hinting at queer love without showing it versus previous uses of the word?
Do we still call it queerbaiting when there's like actual explicit queer content on the screen? Do we still call it that when maybe some other things are going on in that representation? Maybe some other like duplicitous marketing tactics are being used, or maybe there's some sort of really kind of harmful other trope that's being used in representation.
Like the bury your gaze trope, also known as dead lesbian syndrome, the explicitly queer characters are disproportionately likely to be killed off.
Part of the unfortunate thing about the landscape of LGBTQ representation on screen is that there still is not a huge amount of it, and so it's rife for all of these different abuses. Do we apply it to places where there's like virtue signaling in advertising or rainbow washing? Like, they may show actual queer content and themes in these ads or, you know, in a music video, but it's still marketing and insincere tactics to get queer money.
Well, how do you sort sincere from insincere?
I mean, it's really tricky. How do you tell the difference between like queer coding and queer baiting? They can be mistaken for each other. And there's a similarity to them both because they're both using subtext to hint at queerness. And they can both have a negative impact. But I think the difference is there's a big question of intent. Queer coding can be used positively and negatively. Queer coding has historically been used to explore sexuality where this may not have been allowed otherwise, right? Queer baiting, on the other hand, is only used to draw queer audiences into a piece of media, but it has no intention of actually meaningfully exploring queerness. It's always going to be negative because the intention is duplicitous. It's a marketing ploy. And so it's a commercial strategy that emerged in response to, oh, if we tell these progressive stories and these quote-unquote diverse narratives, because the world is changing, people will see us in a certain way and give us support and give us money. But also, we can't make so strong of a statement that we lose, you know, Joe Tractor, who's really homophobic.
Just wants to fuck his tractor in peace.
Just wants to fuck his tractor in peace. What is queer baiting? What isn't queer baiting? There's constant debate between communities because it's a community coined term. And you have all these people from the internet in different communities. So there's so many different definitions going around. And people use this term and propagate this term without defining exactly what they mean, which allows for this evolution of the term, but also can allow for dissolution of it, watering it down, or maybe making it lose meaning because it's getting so muddled.
That happens a lot in all sorts of areas of language. I guess the importance of having it now is that without it, maybe this concept wouldn't be identified and there wouldn't be as much critique of this phenomenon in
mainstream storytelling, for instance.
Right.
Or commercial media.
Yeah, I think it's... I think where I, as someone who is familiar with the history of censorship and queer depictions on screen, but also is somebody who is existing in these fandom spaces, I think that I get really frustrated when I see these terms being used with definitions different than what I've come to know them as. Is this an evolution of a term, or are we overusing it or misusing it to the point that it's losing its meaning? One thing that I've been seeing a lot is queerbaiting is as kind of a catch-all descriptor for behavior by real people in the public sphere. You're seeing a lot in headlines that say like, oh, Ariana Grande and Billie Eilish have been accused of queerbaiting. And what does that mean? People accused singer-songwriter Billie Eilish of queerbaiting in 2021 after she posted photos from like her music video, and she wrote in this Instagram post, "I love girls." And a lot of people, you know, responded to that and was like, "Oh, is this you coming out? Hey, you shouldn't tease us like this. You shouldn't say this unless you're, you know, actually part of the queer community, etc." A lot of people are using this word, queerbaiting, and accusing people of this in a way that can really quickly veer into gatekeeping or demanding people come out or reveal an identity for legitimacy that they might not yet be ready to do so publicly. Also, what is the harm in normalizing, in further normalizing queerness, right? Like, it wasn't that long ago that the term gay panic was a legal defense. The idea that if somebody was in an assault or murder trial, that they could use this phrase, this concept of gay panic, of like, I was freaked out and I didn't know what to do. And, you know, I was really disgusted. So like the fact that we have public figures at this point right now using queer performativity isn't necessarily a bad thing. If we want progress, normalizing queer things is how it gets codified legal support, especially in a time right now where there are, you know, all of these attacks coming from all of these different areas. People have called like Harry Styles' fashion sense queerbaiting. He may be a straight cisgender man, but he's playing with prescribed gender roles in clothing. That's a good thing.
Yeah, he can be a cis straight man wearing a dress in Vogue.
Right, exactly.
Although, let's not forget that cis straight celebrities can perform aspects of queerness publicly to their advantage without reaping the disadvantages, whereas queer celebrities may not have that option.
I think people are a little too quick to ascribe the term queerbaiting to any time they see some sort of something that doesn't necessarily sit right with them on instinct. There's a tendency at this point to kind of use it as a synonym for bad representation. I think that there's a disconnect and a mismatch between what younger viewers nowadays are kind of expecting in queer representation versus what pop culture is providing. So, you know, people are getting used to more representation. They want to see better representation. So, you know, let's talk about that. Let's talk about how do we get better representation? What do we call it when we have specific tropes that might lead to harmful stereotypes, instead of lumping everything under this term queerbaiting? Because if we muddy a term like that and it loses its meaning, we need to be intentional with the language we're using when we're discussing queer representation in media, because we're at a fragile point. We have to have the right language to criticize it and know the history behind that language. We need to be able to specifically say to showrunners, to writers, to creators, to studio executives, like why X, Y, and Z are not okay. And these are the reasons why. Here's what you're doing. Here's how this is harming the community. Here's how you can do it better.
So it's important just to keep this distinction with like queerbaiting versus normalization of the defiance of prescribed gender and sexuality tropes that are very cisgender and heterosexual.
Right. Yeah. Well, and it seems to be, you know, queerbaiting seems to be evolving in some circles as like this catch-all term for any time queer representation isn't done like respectfully or appropriately or positively, but that's not necessarily really what it means. Like, we might be at the point in queer representation in queer society, where we need new terms. We need new language to evolve to describe what we're seeing, which is how queer coding evolved into queer baiting in the first place. What's the shift there that happened where it was like, nope, we're no longer, you know, accepting scraps, and we're noticing that this is, you know, this is being done no longer as like a, oh, hey, cool, man, I can't believe that they're putting this in here for us, this is great, versus they're cowards, why won't they do this?
I guess a lot of people who weren't raised on culture of pre-21st century don't necessarily know what it was like only to have the subtext and not the text.
Right. Yeah. There's a reason why the queer baiting conversation doesn't come up until the late 2000s, early 2010s, when you start to actually have queer representation on screen and you're starting to see what could be. People are getting slightly more than scraps. And so when you see this kind of half attempt, it makes people more furious, I think.
The academic Emma Norden wrote in a thesis in 2015.
Queerbaiting is a historically situated term, assuming that we live in a time and place where queer representation is possible, yet constantly denied. The same people that accuse producers of TV shows from the 21st century of queerbaiting defend TV shows from the 1990s because these are considered to have been produced under other circumstances that didn't allow queer representation. So if these things were produced now, they would have been accused of queerbaiting. But queer coding has a history situated in that time period as a progressive strategy to be able to show these narratives without being in danger of not having it at all. So I think context is really important when we're talking about these terms. And you can't divorce terms from their historical context. Words and phrases and language will evolve, but none of it exists in a vacuum.
Lee Pfeffer hosts and produces the podcast History is Gay, which you can find in the pod places and Patreon and at historyisgaypodcast.com. The Illusionist is an independent podcast trying to make our brains a little better and trying not to make the world worse. You can lend a hand in this endeavour if you want, and yay, it will take very little energy. Just recommend the podcast to someone. Don't interrupt their wedding or anything, save it till such time as an appropriate opportunity presents itself. And you can also Patreonise the show, whereby for as little as $2 American per calendar month, you get live streams with me and my dictionaries, glimpses behind the scenes of the show, and the Illusiverse Discord community, where you can chat with people about such things as the etymology of various different types of chilies, the pain of dropping wine bottles on your feet, and knitting sweaters with animals on. Sounds nice? Well, it is nice. Join us at theillusionist.org/donate. Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is theurgy. Noun, 1. The operation or effect of a supernatural or divine agency in human affairs. 2. A system of white magic practiced by the early Neoplatonists. Try using theurgy in an email today. This episode was produced by me, Helen Zaltzman. The Illusionist music is by Martin Austwick of palebirdmusic.com and the podcast Neutrino Watch. Our ad partner is Multitude. To sponsor an episode of the show, contact them at multitude.productions/ads. The show is off for the next few weeks to gather more etymologies, but there will be a little something in your feed during that time. You can also stay in touch with me at Illusionist Show on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. And find every episode of the show in audio and transcript form, plus the full dictionary entries for the randomly selected words, and listings for events such as the performances of the new live show Your Name Here in Australia and Air Turtle in New Zealand. This is all at the show's forever home, theillusionist.org.